Well, hello, everybody. This is Randy Wootton, CEO of Maxio, and your host of SaaS Expert Voices, where we bring experts in and around the SaaS world to talk about what's happening today and what is on the horizon. And with me, I am very excited to welcome Joelle Kaufman, who's been in B2B SaaS since 1996. She's had roles in product marketing and sales, has been both a CMO and CRO, and over the last 3 years has been running her revenue catalyst consultancy called Go-To-Market Flow. Her focus is on helping companies make and recognize more revenue. Joelle, welcome.
Thank you, Randy. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun getting to know you over the last couple of months as we've been talking about this and then trading notes. It seems like where we would like to spend our time today is really actually not talking about the office of the CFO, but instead, based on your background experiences, really focusing on the CEO and what makes CEOs successful. We were chatting a little bit about this series that I've been writing on LinkedIn called The 7 Secrets of Success for SaaS CEOs, a lot of alliteration there. And you have your own model, which has 5 components, which seems very consistent. So just as a reminder for people who want to see what I've written, you can go to my LinkedIn, and the 7 secrets are tied to overall results, establishing a winning strategy, shaping the values and standards that will guide your company, building an effective executive team, managing your board and investors, allocating capital to balance the yield today with investments for tomorrow, and investing in your tribe, mentor, coach, peer group, et cetera. And so those were 7 that I had. And Joelle, you had 5 that were sort of similar.
Yeah.
But would you mind walking us through your 5? And then I think we're going to deep dive on 2.
Sure. And I do want to say, Randy, I think it's important that the CFO and the CEO are partners and aligned. And so everything we're going to cover, which is important for the CEO, the CFO has a critical role to play. I am a huge believer in metrics and a real believer in avoiding surprises. And that usually means the CFO knows what's coming and knows how to make adjustments at the company level. So for the CEO, number one, you must focus the organization with clarity of vision, of purpose. That will lead to clear missions that support that vision, prioritization, and most importantly, exclusion of what you are not going to do. You must see this all the time, right? There are infinitely more things you want to do and you could do and people have good ideas about. And if you do that, you have no focus and you will burn through the precious capital resources and human resources of the company. So number one, know how to focus. Number two, clear and consistent communication that is understood by the listeners. It is not enough that you say it, Randy. It matters what they hear. And learning how to communicate so that people can hear you is one of the key learning opportunities for the vast majority of CEOs. Number three, Daniel Pink has a phenomenal book called Drive, and it says what motivates people. Right? And it's an interesting question. Do you know what the answer is?
Well, I would think I read the book a while ago.
Sure.
What I think of in general is people want to be able to make an impact. And so I do think that comes into having clarity about what they're trying to do, understand how it ladders up to the overall mission, and then have autonomy to make decisions within their context.
And that is why you are a good CEO, because autonomy is the thing. Now, here's the trick. You want people to have autonomy, but you need transparency. So you have to balance those things, right? We don't like surprises, but autonomy is the only way people will be motivated. Which brings me to number 4. You have to hire, empower, and continuously improve people. Right? There's a saying in Silicon Valley, oh, we're going to just upgrade people. And they mean we're going to fire people and hire new ones. Let's be clear, that sometimes is needed. That is a extremely expensive and damaging thing for the organization. Every time you fire, you lose institutional knowledge. Every time you hire, it costs money and there's onboarding and there's risk. Now, if someone's not performing, if someone's not the right person, of course, as a CEO, as an executive, we make those decisions. But what if upgrading the organization actually meant upgrading the people themselves and giving them the opportunity to grow and learn and demonstrate that they can perform at a higher level. And that's a fantastic thing to do. So I think hire, empowering, improve people is the fourth of my five. And then finally, CEOs are the embodiment of the values of the company. So they have to articulate them, model them, reinforce them over and over again. And if they are inconsistent with their values, nobody will believe the values and they will undermine the credibility of the CEO. I'm not saying what the right values are, right? I'm saying know what your values are and live them, articulate them, and model them.
Well, this is great. It's lots of stuff I would put in the category of how you do your job versus what is that you're actually doing in terms of thinking about leadership capability, right? You got to get your results done, but then how are you doing it in terms of communicating effective, articulating a set of values, living those values, investing in your people? A couple other things kind of pop for me just hearing you talk through it again is very similar to what Mark Benioff did at Salesforce with his V2 mom, where you have the visions, the values, and I think he describes it as methods, obstacles, and metrics, I think. But just having one sheet that is able to articulate where you're going, very important to articulate values and to live those values so they don't become a Dilbert exercise, that people actually see that they are how you reward and recognize people. So that's a wonderful reminder. I was thinking about your fourth one about the hire, empower, and improve people. I'm in the middle of a book, Cultures of Growth, by Mary Murphy. I don't know if you've read her, but she is picking up on that thinking around genius culture versus growth culture. Genius culture being kind of what I was experiencing at Microsoft before Satya came on board. We had geniuses running the organization and what it meant to be the smartest person in the room and how you built political capital, et cetera, versus how do you create a learning environment where people are working together to grow and to, and I think to the point you were making in terms of, we call it grow our own, where you're bringing people in, early stage career professionals, well, then you have to have both invested time and energy in career ladders to help articulate what success looks like at each stage. You have to develop and build out a management program. We call it management excellence in terms of what does it mean to when you make that transition. And then we also have another framework on top of that, the Great Leader Framework, which is for people that are moving from directors to VPs. And now there's another expectation in transition in their career. What does that look like? And a lot of things you were describing in terms of the capabilities of how you get your job is what you're focusing more your energy on as you get more senior. It sounds like that's consistent with how you're thinking. Would you have, before we go into the other ones, anything else around that hire, empower, and improve people in terms of what you've seen companies do successfully or where they make mistakes other than doing the turnover that you were describing?
Sure. I think one of the challenges of leadership is that A, the Peter principle. So we promote people who've been very successful at doing a function, at doing a job, and then we put them in leadership. And overwhelmingly, we think, well, they're human. They know how to lead. It's my experience that leadership is a skill just like sales is a skill or finance or what have you. And if you don't approach it as a skill that can be learned and actually needs to be practiced, right? I don't care if you're a genius or whatever. The number of natural born leaders, I mean, you know, he's controversial, but people will say Bill Clinton was a great communicator. Bill Clinton trained himself in communication, practiced it, got coaching and feedback constantly in order to be great. So the idea that you can be great because, you know, you're just a really great human, that's a fallacy. We have to invest in creating great leaders and then helping leaders remain great. And we'll talk about that when we talk about curveballs a little later. But I do believe that leadership, leaders are the leverage of any organization. And, you know, Carol Dweck's growth mindset, which is very pervasive in education, but it's also critical for organizations because if you have a culture that punishes people when something doesn't work, you get a culture where people don't take risks. Now, there are dumb risks and there are good risks, and we have to help right. people figure that out. But
right.
you want people to take risks, to push the edge of the envelope, to try new things, and it will fail. And I often say, great. What are we going to learn right. and do differently next?
Right.
Now,
right.
to my CFO brethren, let's not spend absurd amount of monies failing. Let's try to fail right. fast. Let's try to learn quickly. But absolutely, let's embrace failure for the learning. Let's embrace what we learn. And that makes us better. And that creates an organization that's willing to take risk, as opposed to an organization that's practicing cover your ass, which is not an organization that's going to be great on any front.
Great insight. I think that idea of leadership is a skill that can be developed over time. And there are lots of different types of leaders. Those mm-hmm. that are lead from the front versus those that are supporting behind. And so you have to find your own natural leadership style. I think I've seen books like, hey, there's seven different leadership styles. I actually was just rereading Peter Drucker's Effective Executive. Mm-hmm. And he talks in that book about what it means to be an effective executive. Now, granted, it's a little bit dated. It came out in 1965. He uses he throughout, and the language is a little stilted. But he, too, makes the point that effectiveness is something that can be learned. And you have to focus on, he has five things you need to focus on, very consistent with what you've been describing. The irony for me is here I am writing these, the seven secrets of success for SaaS CEOs. And basically, I should have started off and said, just go read Drucker. He already said it. I thought I was having original ideas, but no, it wasn't. It's all gone back to the master. But his point around exactly what you're describing is that you build this effectiveness through deliberate intention, and very similar in the idea of how do you drive focus and drive trade-offs. One thing you mentioned in terms of clear communications that's understood by listeners, I totally agree with you. Another book that we were just working on in my marketing group was actually Aristotle's The Art of Rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And it talks about how arguments are built in eros, pathos, and logos, and how you need to be thinking about when you're communicating, how are you using all three of those levers to be effective. How have you found people measure and validate whether they are being understood by their listeners? What's the way that you, other than taking a survey after the presentation, what's the way that you really know that you've landed your message, or that people are really changing their behavior based on terms of where you're directing?
So if I'm going to communicate, and the massive amount of resources of bringing everybody together, I should have an outcome that I'm aiming towards. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be clear, right? If I'm giving an update, I could send that over Slack. I could send that over Teams. Like, I can do that in writing. Why am I communicating? And if I know why I'm communicating, then I have a clear change or a clear action I'm expecting to see. And then the question is, do I see it? Mm. And if I don't see it, the evolved leader says, my message didn't land. Mm-hmm. There's too much else people are hearing. So one of the things I've invested in, and I was very blessed to first be exposed to it in 2003, is something called the process communication model. And what it is, based on psychological research by Collar is his name, Talby Collar. But process communication proves that we all have communication channels through which we hear best and through which we communicate best. And there are styles that work better with some people and better with others. And if we understand who we're speaking to and what they need, not what I need, what they need, and I use the appropriate channel and approach perception to address how you need to hear things, the probability that you will get my message goes up 10x. And the proof on this, by the way, is that the system, process communication, was adopted by NASA for the selection of astronauts and for communicating ground control to astronauts. Because, if something goes wrong, it actually is life-threatening. We need to communicate so the other person can hear. And this is done worldwide. It accounts for cultural bias. It accounts for just different languages. So I find it very useful. I work on it with my clients, and I've been using it. And I have funny stories about that, but that will derail our whole podcast. But learning how to understand how someone else needs to hear. And this is harder as a CEO. You could be in front of 50 people. You could be in front of 5,000 people. How do you do that? Well, you're basically going to have to your Aristotle rhetoric, you're going to have to deliver your message in each of the channels in the same, in the same presentation. And some of them will not be comfortable because they won't be what's most comfortable for you. Who cares? Your comfort isn't what we're trying to accomplish here.
No, I think it's super interesting. I haven't heard of that. Is it a book, the 2003 book?
No. No. This was actually developed in the 60s. So we're, you and I are going Drucker, Aristotle, process communication. it's called, you can go to processcommunication.com to learn more about it. There are books about it.
We'll put it in the show notes.
There's a couple of really popular books. I just have to look them up, and I can send them to you. But it's really a profound simplification of what goes right and what goes wrong in communication. And once you get it and use it, your leadership becomes transformed. Because what is the single biggest instrument of leadership? Communication.
Yeah.
That is what we do as leaders.
I think that's right. I think that, I couldn't have said it better. I think that when I think about what it means to be a leader, which we're going to get to in a second, is ultimately as a CEO, you're responsible for results, delivering results. But how do you get those results as a CEO? I actually do very little. It's more about how do you help people understand where we're going, why it's important, and how they can contribute. So you're getting results through others. And the vehicle for that is communication. And so what does that look like in terms of your all hands? What does that look like? I send a note. When I'm traveling, I call it view from 30,000 feet. I'm coming back on an airport. And I remember when I wasn't CEO, I always wondered, well, what do CEOs do? Because you never actually see them. And so I provide kind of an insight into where I was, what I learned, and really try to embrace the pathos part of communication versus the logos part of communication. And you think about that type of forum and construct is very different than what we do in our QBRs, which is very much about logos. And then there's the how often and frequently you're just doing personal outreach. So with the leadership cadre, we have about 30 people in our leadership cadre, and try to meet those that aren't my direct reports once every 6 months. And so there's that personal interaction as well. So I think to your point, a lot of time is spent in terms of communicating and thinking about the different forums of communication and overall effectiveness. I would say the way that we measure it at Maxio is through, we do employee engagement surveys every quarter.
Like CultureAmp
Everybody does. And a couple of questions in there about understanding, do you have confidence in the company? If people don't believe the message of the CEO, they may think the ship is going sideways. Number two is, do they really understand the strategy of where the company is going? And then we have, like everybody, I imagine, have questions around leadership effectiveness. And that, too, is part of, hey, is the leader helping me understand what I'm doing? Is the manager helping me define the work and where I need to make an impact? And so I'll be super interested in taking a look at that and digging in. So thank you for sharing.
Well, and I'll add a couple of metrics that are not survey-based. But if you have, if you're having high undesired attrition, you have a problem. If you're consistently not hitting your results targets, you have a problem. Yeah. Now, by the way, that problem could be you're setting results that are not in the realm of possibility, or the problem could be people don't know how to do what should be ambitious. I like ambition, but possible. So, you know, one of the things that always takes my breath away is you can just do a verbal check-in with just your leadership team. And simple question, what are the three most important things for the company? Over 70% of leadership teams will not say the same three things. So let me suggest that if your CEO can't align the first team, the probability that the first team is aligning everybody else is zero, non-existent. Yeah. And so, you know, that's really important.
Yeah. That's great. We're actually going to have our executive leadership team meeting. We get together once a month. We're doing it tomorrow. I'm going to lead off with that. The three most important things to be.
Have them write it down on a piece of paper. Yeah. Like have them write it like a ballot. Yeah. So that, you know, even anonymous ballot, but, you know, because the lesson for you is maybe you're in the 20 to 30% that's got it. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably you're going to have some things that are off, and that could lead to, well, are these the right top three, or should we make an adjustment? Because you don't want people just parroting. You want people owning it. Autonomy. They have to believe. Okay. But we should talk about results.
Let's do it, because that I think it's a lead in. And just the bridge I would make is we do. Everyone has one-on-ones. We have a one-on-one agenda, as I'm sure most people do. And in our one-on-one agenda, the top thing is, what are your three priorities? Mm-hmm. And so every week that we meet, or biweekly, we come back and say, okay, so are these still the right three priorities? And then I think also having the, hey, what are we putting in the parking lot, which is around your idea of exclusions and trade-offs. So you can have these conversations about things that seem to be exciting, the new shiny object we need to go work on, but then you're always putting them against the top three priorities. Does this supplant one of these? If so, why? And then trying to, the other thing that does, I think, for people, and this maybe goes into building the effective executive team muscle that we'll talk a little bit about, it gives people space and control over their lives. So they can, if they're feeling overwhelmed, they can always go back to, well, these are the top three things I need to work on this week. And it's not changes every week, but over the next month, am I putting enough energy and exerting enough time to really address the things that are really the top three? And then as long as we're aligned, they feel like they can be successful. Still feel like they're working super hard, but they're not feeling like they're overwhelmed.
The top three for each individual executive could be very different across everyone on the leadership team. And that's okay. Yep. Yep. The question is, what are the top three for the company?
Got it. Totally. Okay, that was new.
I just wanted
that's
to make
what I'm
going to
do. Yep.
I just wanted to make that distinction.
You would hope that the two would be connected, right? That if you're working on the top three for the company, that there's some way for each of the executive team to see how they're supporting and driving it.
Right. Well, and it can be that, you know, one of the top three things is particularly product oriented, and your engineering and product team has all of their top threes focused on that one, but they know what the other two are. And if I can add another thing, the number of times I have CEOs say, well, the top three is that we make our revenue number. And I'm like, okay, that is a measure of having done something.
Right.
It is not the thing. It is the result.
Well, let's shift there. So one of the things we're going to talk about in the seven secrets of success, and it overlaps in terms of the conversation we've just been having around delivering overall results by building a high function revenue engine.
Amen.
Can you talk a little bit about how a team needs to do that and think about it and the four whys and a who, and then we'll just go from there.
Sure. So one of the areas that people trip up is when you say, what's your ideal customer profile? They answer with four or five personas. And let's be real, you sell something complicated at Maxio. There isn't a single person who's going to say, oh, I'm the buyer. There's buying teams. And those buying teams have multiple stakeholders, and those are multiple personas. So I understand how this happens. But who's your ideal customer? Who's the person, the role, the level, the context they're in that's going to champion this? Because entropy is real. People don't like doing something new and different.
Right.
And so it doesn't happen because you're a fabulous salesman. It happens because somebody on the inside says, we need to do this. This problem is so painful, is so urgent, whatever's happening. So understanding your ideal customer profile. And there are, as I said, four whys and a who. So why is your solution a top three priority for your ICP? Before you got there, why is this a top three priority for them? It's really hard to make a prospect change their company's priorities. Like, that's a heavy, heavy lift. It is way easier to find the people who've already made this a priority. And by the way, I don't mean buying Maxio or buying something else. I mean, I'm going to do consumption billing. I'm going to do subscription billing. I need to offer this in my product. great. Well, then I'm going to need a solution to do it. But their problem is there. Number two, compared to anything else they could do, why are there other solutions, including their existing, unacceptable ways to solve this problem? Right? It can't be, well, it's not as good, or, oh, it's a little harder. Like, why is it going to be fundamentally unacceptable? Third, why? Why is your solution 10x better than other options? So one of my funnier stories is I have a CTO I've worked with for many years. I adore him. And we were having a conversation about differentiators. And I said to him, based on our market, what do you think are the most important differentiators that will help our customer, our ideal customer, solve that problem 10x better? And he said, no. You need to look at what we've got and determine what differentiates it from the competition. And I said, well, no, that's backwards. But it's scary what I'm saying, because I'm saying you as a CEO, as a CTO, as a chief product leader, as a sales team, have to say, we know who our ideal customer is. We know the problem that is so painful, it's made their top three. And we know what will be 10x better for them. And that is what we're going to build for them. And we have to do this all, usually to, you know, get before the customer can actually articulate what those things are, because they don't know. They haven't used it. They're used to what they've got. So we have to take some risk. We have to lay a bet. But our bet has to be, we're going to do something that's 10x better. And by the way, if what you're saying is we're going to disrupt an existing technology, well, you're not going to disrupt them by doing everything they do, because they're going to do that better. They've been doing it for a while. You're going to disrupt them by doing something that people need desperately, dramatically better than their other solutions. So who? Remember we talked about all those stakeholders and all those personas? So this is where the personas show up. Who must align to select your solution? Who has to say yes? Because each one of them has a veto. So I'm not suggesting you throw out your persona work. I'm suggesting you see the difference between the ICP and a stakeholder. And finally, and my favorite, why does your ICP need you now? And my caution to anyone who's watching or listening to this podcast is the answer to this question has nothing to do with you. It has to do with them. It has to do with something happening in their career, in their company, in their market. There is something external to you that has made this go from a nice thing to do to, I'm going to spend this quarter getting this thing done. Because it is very hard, unless you're selling something that's very, very cheap. It's very hard to actually buy things. As somebody who's been the buyer inside multiple organizations, even in smaller organizations, the number of hoops, whether it is the CFO hoop, the privacy and data hoop, the CEO hoop, the aligning my colleagues in sales and marketing hoop, there's lots of hoops.
Wow. Well, those are great. And just as you're ticking through them, I'm thinking about our own challenges. And one of the things we would say is playing out is, even though the stock market's going up and large tech companies are driving that increase in value, what you find broadly across the B2B SaaS space is there's been a contraction. And that is due in part because VCs and PEs have pulled back their money. And so what that has led to, with the rising interest rate, what that has led to is CEOs and CFOs saying, hey, pull back spend on internal software. And we're an internal software vendor selling into the office of the CFO, which is also really hard because the CFO is telling everybody else to stop spending. So it's hard for them to advocate for a technology change at this point. So gosh, feeling what you're describing, I think the number one barrier we have with people buying is status quo. It's just easier to stay with what they got. And so I think your point around aligning with the top three problems and trying to demonstrate that your solution is 10 times better, and then what's at stake for that specific persona within the ICP, and salespeople talk about the third order of pain, and you're getting to why are they not sleeping at night, or why is their wife or partner going to leave them when they feel that sort of existential crisis, they're willing to take on the challenges of buying a tool. Let me ask you a question. A couple of things that popped for me. One was under why is your solution 10x better than what they do today? I've been at a bunch of different software companies. I'm not sure anyone really had a 10x better solution outside the marketing that you would describe. So what do you coach companies that are, they've got some differentiation, but it's, I mean, 10x, that's a big,
that's big.
Clearly OpenAI is 10x right. better, but right. you know, in general, because if you don't have that, do you just pull up chalks and go home, or
no, you find
you,
it.
You focus. Yeah. So go ahead.
So look, this is a targeting and qualification problem as much as it is a product problem. So you at Maxio have sold your product successfully to a bunch of CFOs and companies. The question is, what made that group amenable? Why were you 10x better to them? And then how does that inform where you're hunting? What signals you're actually looking for? I'll give you an example from a former client of mine. I was brought in to help them accelerate the growth of a managed service version of their offering. And I started my work talking to them, large team, good company. And I said, after talking to your customers change jobs pretty frequently. And they said, yeah. I said, and they buy you multiple times when they change jobs. You're their play. They're like, oh, yeah. I said, why don't you track when they're changing jobs and proactively go after them? And there are companies that provide that, because that's a growth engine for you. And when they change jobs, you want to reach out to the person who took over where they left. So keep the other job and get the new one. That's a pretty solid growth strategy. And it's already there because you do a good job. You are 10x better to these people than an alternative. Yeah. Now, these people were smaller companies. They didn't have as much resources. They needed a managed service, but there's a shit ton of them, Randy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, it's not the sexy market of, oh, hey, I can go get Salesforce as my customer.
Right.
But it's going to fuel your growth engine. Look at Spotify, right? Like, smaller businesses are a growth engine if you are easy for them to adopt, service them well, and solve their problems. Now, I'm not saying that's what the answer is for you or anyone else. The answer is targeting and discipline about that. Now, the pressure is, but we need more growth. And so what happens is companies are like, all right, we're going to pursue this new market, or we're going to add more salespeople. Now, that can work if that new market has the same pain and you can hunt for it. And your new salespeople can align the buyers and complete. But more often than not, it's a money bonfire, because you don't even know that market and you have no idea what their pain is.
Right.
So I think there's another book, Go Slow to Go Fast.
Yep.
It's a good philosophy when we're saying, okay, we want to grow. What are the growth vectors we can choose? And the model was, before the inflationary period we've been in, the model was growth at any cost. Okay, well, let's go try this market. Let's go try this region, whatever. Now it's efficient growth. Well, efficient growth is about, do you know your ICP? Do you know their signals that they're in pain? By the way, and pain can be desire, right? You were talking about they stay up at night, or they're going to lose their job. A lot of people buy something like Maxio or things I've sold because it can make their career. Look at the history of all the people that bought Marketo and became Marketo champions. It made their careers that they did that. So you can have an ambitious person. Again, this idea when people change jobs or get promoted, there's a set of opportunities. Which ones fit your company? And how are you organizing your revenue engine to identify, engage, and offer value to those people at that right ideal moment. So I guess I have ideal customer profiles and ideal moments.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I think that's great. In fact, so we recently became customers of UserGem to address
That's who I recommended to my client.
Exactly, to address that point, because what we found was once Maxio was in a company, you would have Maxionauts who would know how to use it. But if they left, a new CFO or a new finance person would come in and say, hey, I'm super comfortable with Excel. Why are we spending money on Maxio? And so we needed two things to happen. One was to be alerted when there was a job change so that we could reach out with our customer success team, welcome the new person, and say, hey, let's introduce you to Maxio, how you've been using it to date, and how can we get you trained and learned if you're not familiar with it, so that that prevent churn. And then number two, to your point, most our best customers are those that have used us before. Heck, I was a customer of Maxio Legacy SaaS Optics at Percolate, where I was CEO. And part of the reason I took this job was because it had changed my life. So I knew that 10x value prop, but it's super hard to articulate it unless you've experienced it on the other side. And so I was like, oh gosh. So UserGem allows us as well in our outreach is to go track people to see where they landed, because they're probably going to stay in the same function. And so you go find them and say, hey, remember us? We sent them some Maxio swag, and see if they can advocate for us in their new organization. So I think it's a great call out. We were going to talk a little bit more on delivering results. I would, though, because the way this conversation is unfolding, I think I'd like to shift to the other secret of success around building an effective executive team, specifically about the curveball versus fastball.
Thank you.
I think this is one of these really interesting dynamics where an executive team, that first team, has to build muscle collectively. And it's tied into how do you establish trust, build trust, and how do you react to the inevitable changes that are coming down the pipe. So can you talk a little bit about your curveball versus fastball metaphor and how you see that play out?
Sure. And it's interesting. I believe in the curveball method. It's actually how I live personally as well as professionally. I think I've mentioned to you that I've had a 40-year journey with breast cancer in my family, including my own experience with it. And, you know, cancer and health crises are a complete curveball. They rock your world. In the professional realm, the SVB crisis was a massive curveball. It rocked people's worlds. But when you step back a moment, I would posit, Randy, that 80 to 90% of what your leadership team talks about or deals with day to day are curveballs, because you have other people in the company that are handling the fastballs. It's an unhappy customer. Something in the product isn't working the way it's expected, or it's delayed. We're having capital constraints. What are we going to do with our resources? These are curveballs, right? And how we deal with them isn't something we want to make up each time anew, or really on the fly, right? Any baseball player, and you know I have a son who's one of them, but any baseball player will tell you, you have an approach before you walk up to the plate. So we have an approach before we enter the leadership team meeting or before we have our one-on-one. And our approach has to be about, can we see the curveball? Do we identify it and say, okay, this is not what we expected. It might not have been what we wanted, but it is what we're seeing. Two, can we manage our own emotional reaction? Mm. And this is a big one, right? Like, emotional regulation is hard. You care a lot about the company. Most people that are on an executive team have been wildly successful. They don't like screwing up or failing or making the wrong call. All of those are dysregulating thoughts because you're still seeing the curveball.
Right.
Right? All the things you make the curveball mean, all the what ifs, and you know, it comes down to, that's emotional, and it's flooding your body with all these hormones that put you into your limbic system. Well, that's great if a bear is chasing you and you need to run faster. Right. But if you actually have to make a thoughtful decision, all that stuff coursing through your body is bad for you. You want to get it leveled and get into our very powerful frontal lobe. So we have to be able to recognize it. We have to be able to be patient and cool our own jets. And we have to have an approach. And the approach is going to depend on, what are your strengths? Your strengths as a leadership team, as a company, as individuals. we can understand what our weaknesses are, but how we want to approach the curveball should be about our strengths and being able to, again, calmly say, okay, we're overextended here. We have some strengths in dealing with this kind of situation or some patterns. What do we think about this? And then create a conversation. Oh, Randy, I like that. What if we added this to it? Oh, Randy, mm-hmm. I like that. I'm concerned about this part. What if we shifted it this way? And now your leadership team is literally coming together to figure out how to swing the bat. Mm-hmm. Now, unlike baseball, you may not have to swing it immediately. You might, I mean, SVP was pretty much an immediate thing, right? But most curveballs are actually not moving as fast as they look like. That's actually how they strike out batters, right? So you have a little bit of time to say, okay, let's come up with some ideas and let's step away. Let's look at it again. Let's look at our ideas and let's make a measured choice with some metrics of, is our choice working? Because good news, if the choice isn't working, you don't get out on the first strike. So you get to swing again.
Right.
So
this is a great metaphor here. Have you written about this in this metaphor? Because it's
I have a little bit. I'm still teasing the whole thing out.
Okay.
But yeah, for me, I think what I do when I coach, as a revenue catalyst, is I teach people the curveball method and how to develop their own approach and their team's approach for the curveballs of work. Inevitably, they also approach the curveballs of life.
Right. I think what's interesting is it also ties in with what we were talking about earlier in terms of hire, empower, and improving people and allowing people to take risks. And sometimes those risks don't play out. And I know, gosh, we just had something happen last week at the company. And I was like, oh, for God's sakes, really? But the natural emotional reaction is, well, why did this happen? How do you call out the person that was responsible for it? Scold them and tell them to get back to work. And instead having a mental shift around saying, look, it already happened. So what can we learn from this? What can we do to put guardrails in place as we go forward? And I think, and then there's a lesson learned in there. Mm-hmm. And people are taking risks because we're trying to do something different. Mm-hmm. And then they will learn going forward. I think the executive team's collective ability to manage change and react to change is one of those indicators of a great executive team. And so we, at our executive offsite next week, for example, we're going to have a set of big rocks. And big rocks are those things that are either big problems we need to take on or opportunities we need to exploit. And to your point, we don't have to make the decision next week, but we certainly want to move the thinking forward. Because on the other end, what you don't want to have, I think, is just having the same conversation again and again and again. So there's some way, I think, in the way you described it, is how do you approach this as a team with articulating the goal, being clear about the roles and responsibility. I think about that as decision-making. How are you going to make the decision? Who's on point for the decision? Ensuring there's a line around action. So what's going to, in the next month, how are we going to move this forward? What information or data do we need to go? What experiments are we going to go execute? And then come back as a team and say, okay, what are we going to do now? And then just being humble enough to recognize, like you were describing, like, hey, you may take a strike on this one, but you're not going to go out. And so how do you create context where you're able to invest an appropriate amount of investment and time that you can move it forward without just sucking up everybody's energy and efforts. So those are great guides.
Well, I think that's very wise how you've summarized it. I'll add to you, put a timeline on the decision-making.
Yeah. Right?
We don't need to do it right now, but we need to do it by.
Yeah.
And what are some metrics that our decision was the right one? Because we want to be able to come back. The good thing about baseball is when you strike, the umpire says, that's a strike. In business and in life, when you strike, often we try to hide it. Like, no, it wasn't a strike. It was just a funky swing. Like, no, let's know that was a strike. We don't think that's working. That's not bad. That's just information. So how do we want to, make an adjustment? If you listen to ball players, they will tell you, you have your approach, you see the pitch, and you make an adjustment. You get down two strikes, you make an adjustment. So when we lead our leadership teams, what tells us if our swing is working and what kind of adjustments can we make without judgment? It's all about learning and getting better. if we're always getting better, I think there's another author that writes like 1% better every day or whatever. If we actually are doing that, if we're actually doing that, we're doing it because we're making mistakes and we're learning. And that becomes invigorating.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I talk about this idea of my entire life been trying to operate at the edge of my own ignorance. Right? Mm-hmm. What is it that I can learn or do differently? It's part of the reason I left, go to market tech, go to CFO tech. I was like, whoop, here's a new world, go figure it out. And I'm going to make a bunch of mistakes. I do think there, you know, at some point, a CEO, you got to be right more than you're wrong.
You do.
You got to get the right things done. And so there's judgment that you have to apply in these situations, I think, as an executive team as well. And I guess playing out the metaphor a bit is like how many at-bats you've had. And right. So you start to recognize a curveball, you enter, recognize how to swing the bat in this specific situation and what the expected outcome. Well, Joelle, look, it's been great. We could go on for another hour, but I think we got to wrap up at this point. And so I just want to say thank you very much. I really have learned a lot. I've taken a whole bunch of notes on my outline of this conversation with you. What a great conversation. I've learned a bunch. Congratulations on all your success to date. If people wanted to find you, we were talking about one thing in particular about fantasy forecasts, which we're not going to get a chance to chat about, but it's on YouTube. You've got these 1 minute overviews of how to avoid fantasy forecasts. And we are going to include that in our show notes. Where else would people find you if they want to get in touch with you or follow you? Is LinkedIn the best medium?
You can go to LinkedIn, which is I'm Joelle Kaufman. No double F or double M or double N. It's just Joelle Kaufman. And you can also go to www.gtm, go to market, flow.com. And the name is because when your team, when particularly your go-to-market team is operating at the height of its ability, it feels like a flow state.
Right.
And it's That's a wonderful great. Thing.
Yeah. No, it would be nice to be there. So I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Joelle.
Thank you, Andy.